And I'll also share with you what I didn't want to say in front of her, and that is that Rena is wonderful. She's a very well-known, wonderful speaker about her story. But I think, as I mentioned about a month ago, the person, the survivor who normally spoke here each year, Morris Wishergard, Alav HaShalom, passed away about a month ago. Some of you were able to hear him a few months ago. And so I called someone else, a wonderful woman survivor whom I've heard many times. I've been to Poland with many times. And I spoke to her daughter, and she told me that her mother was too frail to be able, she's now in her 90s, to be able to come here. And so, without any slight on Rena at all, but just to articulate the new era that we're in, she was our third choice. And it wasn't that the other two were busy, which might have been a problem in previous years. But institutionally, we're now facing that reality where finding a survivor to speak is going to be a continuing challenge. In my own shul, our Yom HaShoah program at night has now already moved over to the second generation talking about their experiences, which may very well be the way to come. It certainly is not as good as having someone like Rena speak to us. Okay, so the topic that Gio and Sarah and Samantha asked me to speak about was, how could it happen? It's a very, very challenging topic, and particularly in a very short time. You know, where do I take this? How could it happen? And I actually came up with three questions that I think might trouble some of us, and we'll try to discuss them. One is, how could ordinary human beings turn into murderers, mass murderers? The second question is, how could human beings stand idly by? And a third question, how could clever politicians be duped by the Nazis? So let's look at the first one. How could ordinary men turn into murderers? I use the term ordinary men taken from this book by Christopher Browning, titled Ordinary Men, a very important book that was written, I think, in the 1992. Christopher Browning is one of the premier historians of the Holocaust. As far as I know, he's not Jewish. And he actually starts his book by saying something that, when I first read it, I was so shocked I had to read it again. He says that in March of 1942, after Poland and much of Europe had been occupied for more than 2 years, 75 to 80% of the victims of the Shoah were still alive. I'm sorry, 75 to 80% of European Jewry was still alive. Only 20 to 25% of them had been killed. In March of 1942. About 15 months later, a little more than a year later, mid-1943, the numbers were reversed. 80% of the victims of the Shoah, 80% of European Jewry was already killed. I'm going to correct myself. I'm sorry. I've confused two things. 80% of the victims of the Shoah had already been killed. 20-25% was still alive. In other words, the critical year
and the murder of European Jewry
was 1942 and the very beginning of 1943. The German attack on the Jews, particularly in Poland, was not gradual in many ways, but was like a blitzkrieg. The same way the German armed forces captured countries was the same way they launched their war against the Jews. It was a blitzkrieg. It required a tremendous amount of manpower. And this was at the very same time that Germany is invading the Soviet Union. 1942, the war is raging in the Soviet Union, not to mention North Africa. The Battle of Stalingrad, which is really the turning point of World War II, is the biggest battle of World War II, is going to take place in the very end of 42 and the very beginning of 43, precisely at the time that the Germans are using their manpower to its fullest in the war effort. They are going to also launch this war against the Jews and need their manpower to the fullest for this war as well. Which means that the Germans are going to have to call on people who they might not necessarily have called upon lechatchila as their first choice. The manpower wasn't needed for the death camps. The death camps that Rena mentioned here, the six death camps in Poland, where Jews were brought and, for the most part, murdered within just a couple of hours after arrival, those camps actually had very minimal manpower. But getting the Jews out of their homes, out of their towns, rounding them up, all of the murders that took place of the Jews right outside their towns, in the forest, in the cemetery, that took a tremendous amount of manpower. And that brings us to this book called Ordinary Men. Ordinary Men is the story of Reserve Police Battalion 101. I want to repeat that. Reserve Police Battalion. These are not soldiers. These are not SS men. These are not even really policemen. They are reserve policemen who, because of the great need for manpower, are called upon to come to Poland in order to implement the final solution to the Jewish question. And what I want to do is hand out to you the beginning of this first chapter. What I quoted before was from this forward. The beginning of his first chapter, quite a remarkable scene that he describes. In the town of Josefa, not far from Lublin, in eastern Poland. I'd like you to take a few minutes to read this. Okay, so before we get to what actually happened on that early morning, let's talk about who were these men of Reserve Police Battalion 101. There were about 500 men in this group. Their average age was 39. Most of them were married. These were not young recruits. These were not battle-hardened veterans. They had not fought in the war up to this point. These are people taken from their jobs, most of them actually from the city of Hamburg, which was amongst the least Nazified cities in all of Germany. Most of them were not members of the Nazi Party. Only 25% of them. As Browning writes, these men would not seem to have been a very promising group from which to recruit mass murderers on behalf of the Nazi vision of a racial utopia free of Jews. So let's go back to Major Trapp's offer. Right here we have a remarkable scene. We have an actual case. By the way, the evidence that we have is from 200 interviews. Interviews with 200 men from the 500 men of police Reserve Police Battalion 101 that were done in the 1960s and 70s. That's where this information is from. Here we have a case where a German officer tells his troops, I know this is going to be very difficult. I know for some of you, you might not be able to do it. You could step out. You don't have to do it. They understand that the commanding officer is saying there will not be any repercussions for not obeying this order. Anybody have any idea how many of the men stepped out? 500 and said, if that's the case, leave me out. Sign me to something else. I can't hear.
Zero.
Not true. The interviews give a little bit of contradictory evidence. It ranges from 10 to 12. From 10 to 12 of the 500 stepped out and said, I don't want to participate in this killing. Killing of women, elderly, and children. Loading the men on trucks to be sent to what they assumed was labor. The massacre of about 1,500 Jews of Josefov then commences, and over the course of the day, more men begin to ask to opt out. The reasons that the men gave as the day wore on was quite simply that it was extremely difficult to take a single person, drag that person to the forest. The company doctor had shown them exactly where to shoot the person in the back of the neck. So one-on-one, you take this person, you murder this person, but if you shoot at the back of the neck, the blood, parts of brain, etc., that spread all over, it's quite disgusting. So a number of other people along the day, and the estimates go anywhere from a total of 10 to as high as 20% of the men at some point asked to be given an out. Meaning anywhere from 80 to 90% of the men, of these ordinary men, agree to the mass murder of women, elderly, and children. So in the interviews, they asked, the interviewers asked those members of the Reserve Police Battalion, why? Why did you do it? Why didn't you step out when you were given the opportunity to do so? And there were four main answers that they give. And we'll talk about some other answers that Christopher Browning adds that they didn't say. Number one, the conformity of soldiers. That is, the idea of not walking out on your comrades. If we have a job to do, we should be doing it together. Number two, the political and psychological reality of Nazi Germany in 1942. I would say triumphant Nazi Germany in 1942. Because in 1942, Nazi Germany controlled Europe, controlled most of North Africa, was on its way to Moscow and to Stalingrad, and was clearly winning the war. And all of the even fantasies of the Nazi Party seemed to be coming true. Browning calls it another political planet from the values and vocabulary of liberal democracies in the 1960s. All of that racial propaganda, all of that wartime propaganda, all seemed to be actually attainable and coming true. It was a very different environment than a liberal democracy in the 1960s or 70s when these people were being interviewed after the fact. One of them said the following: only years later did any of us become truly conscious of what had happened then. Only later did it first occur to me that it had not been right. If we try to generalize beyond the Nazis and the war and the Holocaust, I would call it people caught up in the moment, in the frenzy. A third reason that they gave was that the Nazi view of the Jew as the enemy had been assimilated. That they understood that the Jew was a mortal danger to Nazi Germany, and what they were doing was really saving their country. And last but not least, some of them said, if we don't do it, others will. So what difference does it make if we step out? So, if we want to look at it not only from their perspective, but from Christopher Browning's perspective, which is that of a researcher and an historian, Browning adds a number of other factors in addition to what those interviewed said. First of all, he rejects the idea that these people were brutalized by war. As I mentioned before, none of these people are battle-hardened veterans. It's not like they've seen lots of people dying on a battlefield and they've become hardened. These are all people who were pulled from their shops, pulled from their jobs, and sent to Poland, and have not faced any battle at all. So what is it, in addition to what they said, that could explain this? Well, first of all, there's a famous prison experiment done by a Philip Zimbardo at Stanford, where they took a random division of people into prisoners and guards. And they found that very quickly, people assuming their roles as guards began to become sadistic, to dehumanize and humiliate the so-called prisoners. Meaning, there was sadistic behavior from those who had been previously screened as normal by a battery of psychological tests. What this means is, every one of us every ordinary human being is capable of terrible brutality. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the former Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, put it this way: every one of us is capable of being a beast. A second experiment, slightly differently, by Milgram at Yale University. Some of you may have seen this film or read an article about it called Obedience, in which people are put into a situation where they think they're administering electric shocks to people who make mistakes on a test. And there's somebody in a white lab coat who's telling them to administer shocks, and according to the dial, they think they're administering shocks in increasing voltage to the point where it says on the dial, danger. And they keep administering the shocks in large numbers. Also seems to reflect this idea. Browning says something about these particular soldiers. He said that they weren't soldiers, sorry, they're reserve policemen. He says that perhaps many of them were thinking about their future careers, because as it turns out, many of them actually did become policemen after the war. And so he postulates that perhaps their career ambitions were part of their decision not to step out of line. And then he adds the issue of ideological education. There was a one-month unit of basic training that all of these soldiers received. Ideological education, which included sessions like, quote, understanding of race as the basis of our worldview, end quote, or maintaining the purity of German blood, or the Jewish question in Germany. This was part of the basic training that they received, that German soldiers received. Not only that, every day or every other day, soldiers were kept updated about current events, and the current events had to be given from the quote-unquote proper understanding and ideological perspective. As Browning says, the denigration of Jews and the proclamation of Germanic racial superiority was so constant, so pervasive, so relentless, that it must have shaped the general attitudes of masses of people in Germany, including the average reserve policeman. A fifth factor, he says, is not only the conformity of not breaking ranks with your comrades, but also being seen as a coward and not being willing to carry out the orders. He adds one more thing as well, and that is the German culture is one that elevates conformity and obedience to authority, just as American culture, as an example, as a counterexample, elevates the idea of rugged individualism. In Germany, the historical cultural tradition is actually quite the opposite. And obedience to authority and conformity are actually important cultural values. Ordinary Men is actually in controversy with another book that came afterwards, written by Professor Daniel Goldhagen from Harvard. Professor Daniel Goldhagen wrote a book called Hitler's Willing Executioners. He used the same raw material, the same evidence of the interviews of the 200 men in the 60s and 70s from Reserve Police Battalion 101. He comes to a very different conclusion. To Goldhagen, these are not just ordinary men, they're ordinary Germans. Ordinary Germans, and he spends, I mean, his book is about 700 pages. It's quite a tome to get through. And he spends about half the book talking about how deeply rooted anti-Semitism was in Germany in the 19th and early 20th centuries before the Nazis come to power. Browning takes issue with it. Browning actually writes, I think very correctly, I wish Goldhagen was right. I wish we could isolate this to this one national group, and all of us would feel much better about ourselves and the rest of the world. But Browning maintains that if the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 could become killers, what group of men cannot? So how could it happen? If the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101, when given the option to step out, or their commanding officer could do it, it tells us something more generally about the human potential, violence and brutality. I'm conscious of the time. Okay. So, I want to move on to the second question. How could it be that human beings could stand idly by? Question of the bystanders. And here, there is a... I would want to start with the case of something that took place in March 1964. Give me Genevieve. Kitty Genovese was a woman in Queens who was brutally murdered, stabbed repeatedly, and according to the news reports at that time, 37 eyewitnesses not only didn't intervene, not one of them called the police. So there's been some research into this. And a little bit, the story has to be revised. A little bit, the story is not exactly the way some of us may have heard it at first. One of the things that researchers have found is that the people in question, the 37 people, most of them did not see the whole thing. They only saw a piece and didn't see the entire puzzle. They didn't see the whole series of events. So they might have been confused, or they might have gotten it wrong, or they might not have exactly understood everything. I mean, we could say, yeah, they should have understood, but maybe they themselves were not entirely sure of what was happening because most of them didn't witness the entire series of events. I would like to posit that that is also true of many of the bystanders. Many of the bystanders also did not witness the entire series of events, but saw pieces of the puzzle. And maybe we would want them to have put the puzzle together. Certainly in hindsight, it's easy for us sitting in our living room chairs to understand the whole picture. But at the time, they saw pieces of the puzzle, not all of it. But there's much more than that to try to understand how people could stand idly by. This was wartime. This was total war. Everyone was struggling to survive. To survive in Nazi-occupied Europe, if you were a Jew, was almost impossible. If you were not Jewish, it was very difficult. As an example, in Poland, the Nazis murdered 3 million Polish Jews. They also murdered 3 million Polish Catholics. Now, it's true that the Jews, they murdered 90% of the Jews. They murdered 10% of the Polish Catholics, but 3 million Poles is a lot of people. And if you're a Pole living under Nazi rule, you are not having a picnic. It could be that one of your close relatives or friends has been taken away, either arrested or murdered or resettled somewhere forcibly. Not only that, but if you help a Jew, let's say you give a loaf of bread to a Jew, or you keep a Jew in your home overnight for one night, You and your family are subject to the death penalty. When we say, why didn't the bystanders do more? What is it exactly that we expected the bystanders to do? This was not a liberal democratic state where they could go demonstrate in the streets. They would have been beaten, arrested, murdered. Do we expect that they would have given a loaf of bread to a Jew who was hungry? Well, that would have been a humane thing to do. But if I was put in that position, and I had to risk my life and the life of my family in doing it, would I do it? So what exactly did we expect the bystanders to do? There was a terrible fear of Nazi reprisal. The Nazis were draconian in their reprisal policies. And so therefore, people cowered in fear. Not only in terms of the Jews, they cowered in fear for their very lives all over Nazi-occupied Europe. I don't mean by this to exonerate everybody. I don't certainly mean to exonerate those people who collaborated with the Nazis, because there were many of those people too. I just mean to try to get us off of our high horse that we so often sit on in judgment of other people, and to understand that their situation was, let's call it, complex. Difficult, not simple. The third topic that I want to focus on is, how is it possible that clever politicians were duped by the Nazis? And I want to look at two particular groups. First of all, in the Weimar Republic, when Hitler became chancellor in January of 1933, the veteran politicians all thought they could control him. They all thought that they would really be running the show and he would be the figurehead. After all, Hitler in certain ways was least likely to succeed. This is a guy who was a failed artist. He never went to university. In the army in World War I, he rose to the very high rank of corporal. Everybody understands what the rank of corporal is? You're a private when you come in. After a while, they give you a second stripe and they make you a corporal. So he's a person who's shown absolutely no potential for great success. And yet they were wrong. But not only were they wrong, the second group of clever politicians are the European leaders. The European leaders also were duped by them. I want to take us back to 1938. 1938, Hitler demands, as Chancellor of Germany, that the Sudetenland, which was a part of Czechoslovakia that was heavily German, ethnic, be returned to Germany and be reunified with Germany. It was part of the land that was taken away from Germany at the end of World War I. Now, this is after Hitler had violated the Treaty of Versailles numerous times. The Treaty of Versailles said the German army cannot be more than 100,000 men. Hitler violated that and began to build a large German army. The Treaty of Versailles said Germany could not have an air force. He's building an air force. The Treaty of Versailles said that they're not allowed to bring troops into the Rhineland, the border with France. They do that. The Treaty of Versailles says that Austria and Germany are not allowed to reunify, to become one country. They do, in 1936. Why is it that the Allied leaders, the leaders of the European countries, allowed this to happen? After all, Germany had no army to speak of. The Allies could have marched into Germany and said, "You violated the Treaty of Versailles. We're not going to let you do this." Well, there are a few reasons. Number one, Europe was traumatized by World War I. There had never been a total war like World War I. 35 million men died in World War I. And tens of millions more were wounded in very serious ways. There was literally a shortage of men of marriageable age after the war. Europe was traumatized. It was called the war to end all wars. Nothing could be worse than this. And so therefore, the European leaders were desperate to maintain peace at almost any cost. There's another reason. The Treaty of Versailles was a very harsh treaty imposed on Germany at the end of the war. It wasn't the treaty that Woodrow Wilson wanted. It was the treaty that the European allies wanted. And there were many things that by the 1930s, even the European allies realized were really quite unfair. And therefore, there was a certain measure of guilt that they had about imposing this terrible treaty, and so perhaps we can let certain things slide. It's okay. So in 1938, the leaders of Britain, France, Germany, Nazi Germany, and Fascist Italy meet in the city of Munich in Germany about Hitler's demand for the Sudetenland, part of Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia, by the way, was a liberal democracy at the time. Czechoslovakia was not invited to the country. And at Munich, the leaders of Britain and France agreed that Sudetenland should be handed over to Germany. That a part of one country should be given to another country without that country's involvement, of course. And Hitler promised in return, "This will be my last territorial demand in Europe." Quote, unquote. "This will be my last territorial demand in Europe." And some of you may have seen the newsreel footage of the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain as he comes down the steps of the plane, landing in England, waving the treaty and saying, "We have achieved peace in our time." That was November 1938. In March 1939, the Nazis took over the rest of Czechoslovakia. And everyone understood that the leaders of Britain and France had been duped. But they were given a promise. The promise wasn't worth the paper that it was written on. Most military historians believe that November 1938, Germany was not yet ready for war. They had not yet fully rearmed. By wagering everything on peace, the leaders of England and France ended up being complicit in World War II, which was far more devastating than World War I. We estimate about 60 million people were killed in World War II. In the face of an aggressor, the desire for peace can actually be exploited as a weakness. Of course, their well-intentioned desire for peace prevented them from stopping Germany in 1938, when they could have much more easily than when war broke out at the end of 1939. And I want you to turn the page that I gave you from Walter Le Cœur's The Terrible Secret. It's a book about when did the Holocaust become known and how did it become known. Democratic societies demonstrated on this occasion, as on many others before and after, that they are incapable of understanding political regimes of a different character. Not every modern dictatorship is Hitlerian in character and engages in genocide, but everyone has the potential to do so. Democratic societies are accustomed to think in liberal, pragmatic categories. Conflicts are believed to be based on misunderstandings and can be solved with a minimum of goodwill. Extremism is a temporary aberration. So is irrational behavior in general, such as intolerance, cruelty, etc. The effort to overcome such basic psychological handicaps is immense. It will be undertaken only in the light of immediate and painful experience. Each new generation faces this challenge again, for the experience cannot be inherited. When you think about how all of us are educated, how all of us educate our children, we educate them to believe that people are generally good. When they have disagreements, we want them to talk it out and work it out amongst themselves. We are hardwired, growing up in liberal democracies, to believe these things. And it's a handicap in facing a Nazi Germany or other totalitarian regimes where the values are completely different. For us, the concept of evil is hard for us to swallow. We don't like to believe it really exists. We prefer to believe that that is something that's somehow made up, or temporary, or due to extenuating circumstances. We tend to try to excuse it. But there is evil. Sadly. There is evil. I want to conclude by quoting Elie Wiesel, who was once asked, "What is the most important lesson of the Shoah?" It's a great question. A great question to ask Elie Wiesel. His answer was that you can get away with it. That you can get away with it. Ordinary men can become mass murderers. Human beings can stand idly by. Clever political leaders can be duped. You can get away with it. Of course, not every persecution is a Shoah. Not every murder is a genocide. The Shoah is an extreme in its scale, but the ingredients that make it possible always there. Thank you.